As I advertised on Friday, we'll talk about, well, this week we'll talk about different interpretations, and today I'll talk about the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. In some ways, this is the clearest interpretation. It's the one that gives you the clearest picture. It sort of tells you, you know, it gives you a version of what's happening in quantum theory. Okay, so so this was originally developed by Louis de Broglie back in, I think, 1927. And then the ideas were kind of rediscovered by David Bohm, published papers in 1952. But those are very readable papers, so I recommend them if you're interested. The one thing that David Bohm really added of what de Broglie had done was to give a treatment of measurement. De Broglie himself, it looks like he was discouraged from pursuing these ideas after the 1927 Solvay conference. There were some criticisms. But when you understand how measurement works in this model better, then really the interpretation is fine, and it reproduces all the predictions of quantum theory. So I'm going to give you the case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But you can, so the treatments of the de Broglie-Bohm, the treatments of this type of approach have been given also for quantum field theory, all the way up to what's required to do the standard model. So this is a fairly versatile approach. But we're going to treat non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So we have some wave function over n particles. Like this. We're going to take this to be distinct particles, so we don't have to worry about identical particle statistics. And they evolve, this wave function evolves by the Schrodinger equation. Each of these, of course, is a vector in three space. So the whole wave function is defined on configuration space at any given time. So if we're providing a realistic interpretation of quantum theory, so an interpretation where there's some notion of realism, some notion of reality, then we should say what the ontic state is. So in the de Broglie-Bohm model, the ontic state at time t it's worth commenting that even here we've introduced some structure into the what we mean by reality. We're saying there is a state at time t. You can imagine interpretations where you didn't try to attribute any kind of reality at a given time, but it was done in some different way. Okay, so in the de Broglie-Bohm model, there is an ontic state at each time t, and it's given by specifying, well, the wave function at that time t, and then also specifying a particular position in configuration space for the particles. I'm going to represent the actual positions of the particles by uppercase x's. The reason for that is to indicate that in this case, this is a function, so these are arguments in a function, whereas here, these positions are meant to correspond to the actual positions of actual particles. That's the key thing about the de Broglie-Bohm model, is that you say that there are actual particles having actual positions.
The previous remark about the ontic state you said is there is a model that ontic state is not defined at given time.
Well, I'm just saying in principle, you could imagine that you don't try to that there's some, I mean, I don't know of an example of such a model, but in principle, you could imagine some sort of version of reality in which you didn't attribute states to given times, but in some other form, it's possible
so
in principle.
No, like, which means there is no physical reality at some period of time.
One of the things that happens in physics is you have to give up on sort of notions you took to be obvious previously. So even in special relativity, the notion of absolute simultaneity, that there is a sensible notion of now had to be given up. And it could be that in interpreting quantum theory, we have to give up even more radical notions, like the notion that there is even a way of talking about a given time. So far as the de Broglie-Bohm model is concerned, we're not giving that up. It's actually conservative in that sense. And incidentally, the fact that we have to specify a wave functional across at a given time, when this is a non-local object, it corresponds to many different positions, does lead to problems with special relativity. The model is non-local. It's not consistent at the basic level with Lorentz invariance, although statistically it is consistent if you do it for relativistic quantum theories. But at the underlying level, it's not going to be. So this is a function on configuration space. And these are the actual positions. This is the actual position of the system in configuration space, specified by giving an actual position for each of the particles in three space. In some sense, this model overturns the idea that you can't give a precise position in quantum theory. In the de Broglie-Bohm model, you do give in the de Broglie-Bohm model, you do give precise positions for each of the particles, but still, all the statistics of quantum theory, including the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, are satisfied. So that comes out subsequently. But yes.
You said that this approach is versatile. It could incorporate quantum field theory. But then I see that if you try to do quantum field theory, you have particle creation and annihilation.
Right, so it doesn't work. So when you go to quantum field theory, what you do is you use a version of quantum field theory where instead of providing a wave function over particle positions, you provide a wave functional over different field configurations. So for every field configuration, the wave functional gives an amplitude. And then for a different field configuration, you get a different amplitude. And so in this case, the basic sort of objects are the particle positions, whereas in the quantum field theory versions, the basic objects are field configurations. So it's sort of treated differently, and you can read about it in Bohm. Bohm has two papers from 1952, and in the second paper he talks about that. Any more questions? Okay. So now we need to give the dynamics for the ontic state. And it's given by, well, the Schrodinger equation. This is just a Schrodinger equation. And by another equation called the guidance equation, it has a very strange form. I'll try to make this form seem a bit more sensible to you. I should say I'm going to denote, I'm going to put x for this. And I'm going to put X for just for shorthand. So when we calculate, this is to calculate the velocity of the nth particle. And we calculate it by this expression, which we evaluate by putting first of all, we do the this requires some differentiation. We calculate this, then afterwards we evaluate it at the given position of all the particles. Okay. So each of the particles has an actual position, and we evaluate this for the actual position of the particles. And we have this equation for all n. Is this? So the lowercase x is just the argument inside these wave functions, whereas the uppercase x is interpreted to be the actual position of actual particles. Because in standard interpretations of quantum theory, you don't imagine that there are actual particles having actual positions, whereas in the de Broglie-Bohm model, you do. That's kind of the key idea. So this is the dynamic. In addition to these two assumptions, sometimes a third assumption is added. And this is that the density of particle positions, I'll explain what I mean by the density in a moment, at time zero is equal to the wave function squared evaluated at the given points. This is the probability density for finding the particles at some position. So what I mean by that is imagine that you repeat the experiment many, many times. Well, each time you do the experiment, there will be some actual positions in this interpretation for the particles. Then you do the experiment again, and the positions may be different, and again, and again, and again. And in that way, by looking at an ensemble of many repetitions, you'll build up a probability density. So this is a probability density over an ensemble of runs of the experiment.
Okay. Then the axis for the probability density would be lowercase x.
Would be what, sorry?
Lowercase x.
No, these are uppercase x because these are the actual positions of the particles.
But if like x's are the actual position of the particle, then rho would be what? But if there is
no, because the whole point the interpretation of this rho is that it's built up over an ensemble. So every time we do the experiment, so we have some preparation. Okay. Out comes the system in a certain state, and then we look and see where the particles are. And we can plot this on a graph. Okay, then we do the experiment again, and we look and see where the particles are this time, and they could be somewhere else. Okay, we repeat again the preparation, and we get another point on here. And then we do it again, and we get another point. Okay, so we're building up an ensemble of many repetitions of the experiment and looking in each case at the initial position. Of course, we can't actually see this ourselves, but nevertheless, it is the case that every time we prepare the system, there will be some large x, uppercase x. And we plot that on the position. We plot that into configuration space. And eventually, we'll build up, if we do it many, many times, we'll build up a distribution over configuration space.
Are we, like in this model, are we believing that the position of the particle before measurement is equal to the position of the particle after the measurement?
We haven't talked about measurement yet. We'll treat measurement later.
So in what sense is this then, by what random process is this ensemble then generated? If we say we start with the same ensemble generator,
right. So that's a problem for this interpretation. So why would we believe this? You know, this sort of seems to be almost assuming the answer. Not quite, but almost. And so people who work on this model worry about that. And people have shown that even if you start off with a distribution which is quite different from psi squared initially over your ensemble, then very quickly, in most circumstances, so long as you coarse grain a little bit, not much, you'll get rho tends to psi squared after very short time intervals. And that follows just from these equations. There's some very nice computer simulations showing, you know, it's quite convincing to see a computer simulation, you just showing that if you start with a distribution which is not psi squared, then very quickly the thing becomes equal to psi squared. There was another question, yes?
How do we understand the concept of the logic state and then also that we can have an ensemble? Like, because in an ensemble, we are assuming we have n copies of something.
So what I mean by an ensemble is I'm talking about, you know, like you do experiments one after the other. You do an experiment, you collect some data, then you do it again, which is what you do in quantum experiments. You always keep repeating your experiment. So that's the kind of ensemble I'm talking about. And each copy of that ensemble will have its own ontic state. Now, if you prepare them the same way, then they'll each have the same wave function, because that's something you can control in principle. But you can't control these particle positions, so that will change every time you do it. So what I mean by an ensemble is in time, when you repeat the experiment many times. I don't mean an ensemble at one given time, but in are there any more questions? Okay. So now what happens if we make these three assumptions, including that one, and what happens as the system evolves? And the answer is, if the distribution at time zero is rho at time zero squared then then we have this is true also for all later times. Actually, it's also true if you were to evolve the system backwards, it would be true for all earlier times as well. But we're taking this to be our initial state. The property that if the distribution is given by psi squared at a given time, then it's true for all later times is called equivariance. And if you search on that in the context of the de Broglie-Bohm model, you'll find various attempts to prove things like that this is the most natural equation or under certain assumptions, the only equation that will have this property.
To understand the rule of zero, can we make an analogy between the graph you showed the previous class, like the graph that ontic state lambda and the...
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Like, is this like...
It's exactly the same thing, yeah. So this is an example of a psi-supplemented model where you have the psi is a real thing, but also there are some additional variables, which are the positions. And so this is an example like that. And what that graph meant was, maybe I should have made this clear last week, under many repetitions of the experiment. So you build up an ensemble over many repetitions. This property that rho is equal to psi squared is sometimes called equilibrium or quantum equilibrium. Thank you. in the community of people who work on this. Now, if you don't assume rho is equal to psi squared initially, then there's lots of work showing that under natural assumptions, it very quickly becomes true as long as you coarse grain just a little bit. Those are attempts to show that a system, even if it's not initially in equilibrium, will very quickly relax to being in equilibrium. So Anthony Valentini is the person who's worked on that a lot. So we can try to just motivate this guidance equation a little bit. Let's go over here. So note so you'll find just in standard quantum textbooks this equation. This is the equation for the quantum probability current. And it satisfies sort of equation you'd expect probability current to satisfy if this thing is the probability density. And this J here is just the the vector made out of the currents for each of the particles. So if we put that the density, the probability density is equal to rho squared, and that the current is given by the probability density times some velocity, this velocity is just the a list of the three velocities. Then we get just a classical continuity equation. This is just the classical continuity equation, except that it's for a fluid in 3n dimensions. Slightly different from, say, a fluid that you might treat in classical physics. then this equation here So this equation I start is just the guidance equation that I gave you over there. Is there still a question in the homework or the tutorial about this? Okay, so there'll be a question on this quantum probability current.
I think you guys got this on Friday, right?
Oh, you've already done it. Okay, right. So this was familiar to you already. Good. Okay. So this was a little bit hand wavy. If you really want to find, I mean, to really prove this, you should look in one of the papers on the Debreu-Bohm approach. Okay.
Where is the star?
Sorry?
Where did you put the star?
Oh. There. Okay. So to understand this model, there's no substitute for just sketching some examples out, see how the thing really works in practice. And of course, it's also not, especially nowadays, it's quite easy to put these equations into a computer and get the computer to draw the trajectories. But even without using a computer, you can very simply sketch them. So there's a few principles that help you to sketch these trajectories. So the first is the no-crossing principle. The velocity in configuration space is a single-valued function of psi and its first derivative evaluated at the position big X or uppercase X. So what that means is that if you have a given wave function, the velocity is a function of the position in configuration space. Which means that for a given wave function, the trajectories can't cross. So if I can just draw this schematically. So of course, really, X corresponds to many different dimensions. I'm just drawing one here. So if we have a particular position here in this configuration space at a given time, so we have a particular wave function at that time, then it's impossible for two trajectories to pass through that point in different directions, because that would mean that x dot was not single valued. And here we know that it's single valued. Is that clear? It's a slightly strange principle because these trajectories aren't crossing in these trajectories aren't crossing in a given system. They're not two different particles. This is we're talking about one. If we run the experiment once and we have one run of the experiment, then this could be the trajectory. And then we know that in another member of the ensemble with the same initial state, it's impossible to have a trajectory which crosses this one. So it's a sort of odd kind of principle. The trajectories can't cross, even though we're talking about different members of the ensemble. Is that point clear? And then the second principle, observation, which allows us to draw trajectories, is that rho is equal to psi squared. At all times. So these two, I'm going to show you how to draw trajectories for a few situations. These trajectories, these two principles allow you to get the sort of basic ideas of how these trajectories will look. They don't give you all the details, but they give you enough that you can understand what the Breuer-Bohm model will say in different situations. So here are some examples. First example. This would be a evolving Gaussian wave packet. So imagine we start off, and this we're going to keep this simple. This is now just a single particle in one dimension, to keep it simple. So we can start off with the particle, the wave function squared, giving you the modulus of the wave function squared, giving you some Gaussian. And we're going to assume, according to this third assumption, that the particle themselves are therefore distributed according to this same probability density over the ensemble. So that means we'll have, over the ensemble, we'll have lots of different initial positions. There'll be more positions in the middle and fewer as you go off to the tail. Let me just draw. I'll use yellow chalk so I can see what I'm doing. Let me just draw a few of them. And also, this wave packet is spreading, so that by the time it gets to be over here, and maybe it's also moving, so by the time it gets to be over here, it's broader. And it's displaced a little bit. So now the trajectory is, well, they have to start, they start off here and they end up over there because rho is equal to psi squared at all times. So the part of the trajectories have to move with the modulus squared of the wave function. And also they can't cross. So in this case, they're just going to move. And there'll be there'll be some wiggles perhaps on the way, but they'll just move over like this. And sorry, my these aren't there. Okay. So the trajectories will get further apart as the thing evolves, and they'll stay with the wave packet. And I'm just sketching these. But all of this, if you did it properly and used these equations, then that's what you would see, I mean, in roughly speaking. So in particular, these trajectories aren't allowed to cross. Are there any questions? Is it clear? Okay. Good.
Okay, each trajectory is not necessarily
the cross. Each of these trajectories is the trajectory of the uppercase x, the actual position of the particle in this model, in a given run of the experiment. So you run the experiment once and with a given wave function, which gives rise to this, and then you'll have some initial position. You don't know what it is, but there'll be some initial position. And it evolves along a trajectory. And then you do it again, it evolves along another trajectory. And so on. Yes.
Are these trajectories stable? So when you make a small displacement in the initial condition, will that give you a small displacement in the final position?
So, I mean, these are the equations. So you can imagine having bifurcation points where just a tiny change in the initial position will give rise to quite a big change in the final position. And actually, when you want to explain, so there are these proofs that even if you don't have rho equal to psi squared at time zero, you get that subsequently. And I think those proofs tend to rely on some of these instabilities. So they aren't necessarily stable. It depends on you know, the particular Hamiltonian and the particular wave function and so on. But there's no reason for them to be stable in that sense. Any more questions? OK, so this is obviously a very simple example. A more interesting example is a double slit interference. Even before I do that, there's an example that I don't have it here in my notes, but it's interesting, which is imagine you have let's just call this is just position. You have a barrier, so a potential barrier, and so you have a wave packet that comes in initially, and then it has some probability of tunneling through this barrier and some probability of being reflected. So what you'll have in this situation, if I plot it in time, is you'll have a Gaussian wave packet comes in, and then part of it, if I can just, I'll just draw the rough sense what happens. Part of it will be reflected, so going out this direction, and part of it will be transmitted. This is where the barrier is. So if I can, you can imagine so a few positions along here, and this is a good place to look at your question. So what's interesting now is that the particles at the front, So remember, you have to preserve the distribution, rho equals psi squared, and also you're not allowed to have the trajectories crossing. What that means is that the particles at the front have to be transmitted. If we assume, you know, let's say a roughly equal split, then the particles in the first half of the wave packet will be transmitted through here. And as they do, they'd also have to spread so that they occupy the wave packet going out. And the particles at the back will be reflected. And also, they will spread so that they now have the same width as the distribution function is supposed to have. Is that clear what I'm saying here? Yeah.
But this no crossing picture only is really useful in one spatial dimension, right?
So if you're in more than one spatial dimension, I mean, the no crossing principle seems to give you, roughly speaking, the trajectories you get. If you just assume that there's no strange stuff happening, like sort of twisting and curling.
Why
so
would there be no twisting happening?
Well, there could be. I mean, this equation, one way to derive it is to assume that rho is equal to psi squared, and then also that you have various invariances, such as Galilean invariance. So that sort of rules out twisting. So, I mean, you're right that in principle, the no-crossing principle, if you had more than one dimension, you could imagine particles from the back getting through to the front. That doesn't seem to happen in the actual calculations. And the reason is you know, because of the exact form of this equation. So this is really just a heuristic principle to give you trajectories. And it seems to work, actually, for the higher dimensional cases as well. Yeah, okay, so, and this answers your point. There is a bifurcation point here because there's a certain point in this initial wave packet where if you're to one side of it, you'll go, you'll tunnel, and if you're to the other side, you'll reflect. So another example is the double slit. And in this case, it's quite hard to draw, so I'll just pass out some things I printed off. Can you pass those out either side, and I'll pass a few more down the back. You pass. Oh, okay. Maybe you can pass. Is that enough? I hope it's enough. Sorry, I think I... okay, yeah, so... So if you look at the diagram, hold it here. So you have two slits at the bottom, and then the particles come out, and now you can see that any particle that comes through the slit on the one side will end up at the screen on the same side, and any particle that comes through the slit on the other side will end up at the screen on that side. So because they don't cross particles, you actually know, in this case, you know from where the particle is detected which slit it went through. You can see that these trajectories kind of wiggle as they go through, because the wave function is doing all sorts of funny things here, and that's essential because at the end, you want to reproduce the interference fringes. So there are some places, if you draw a line across any point here, there are some places where no particles arrive, and some places where the particles are more likely to arrive. Another interesting thing to notice is, so the wave function as it goes through here, it spreads out from each slit, sort of locally, not instantaneously. And so it's only these wiggles, if you look at the wave function coming from here, the wiggles on the other side only start to happen once they start to feel the effect of the wave function coming through the slits on this. So these wiggles over here only start to be felt once they feel the influence of the wave function that came through here. So the evolution of the wave function is essentially local. I mean, this is non-relativistic quantum theory, so it's not strictly local. But if you ignore this state, as the wave function goes through here, it kind of spreads out. Okay, and likewise, as it goes through, it spreads out. If you look at the trajectories from here, they tend to be pretty straight until they enter the region where the influence from the other slit is felt, and then they start to wiggle. And that's because, you know, you're using this equation, and so the trajectories are feeling the influence of the wave function, and it's only when they start to feel the influence of the wave function coming through both slits that the wiggling kicks in to reproduce interference. So this this plot was first done in the late 1960s, and so David Bohm himself had kind of stopped working on this model, and it was only when he saw these plots that were done by Chris Dewdney that he kind of got excited about it again, because he could see how it answered one of the most basic questions in quantum theory: how you reproduce interference. There's something very compelling about seeing an actual picture. And to do these plots back in the late 1960s, were very difficult, because, you know, in those days you didn't have laptop computers, and Chris Dewdney, who did the programming, he had to write the program and then have it produced on a big stack of cards, you know, with holes in that indicated the program, and then feed that into the machine, which reproduced these plots. So it was actually quite a difficult thing to do. He also produced these films of the particles moving around that are quite interesting to watch. You know, on these old 8mm films. And he brought them here to the Perimeter Institute when we were in the old building, and he showed these old films just to see what they look like. Okay. So the next topic on the de Broglie-Bohm model is how it how it reproduces measurement. This is kind of crucial. Try hitting this button. So let's take a simple example. Imagine we have a particle whose position we're going to measure. And it's It's initially in some superposition. I'm not going to put a 1. It's initially in a superposition like this of two wave packets that are non-overlapping. Now we're going to introduce some measurement apparatus. And the measurement apparatus has a pointer. And we'll label the position of the pointer by y. So the position of the system we're measuring is labeled by x. The pointer is labeled by y. And it's such that, I don't have room here, I'll just move over here. Such that so this is the initial state of the pointer in some zero state. And if we evolve this under the Schrodinger equation, we're assuming that the interaction between these two systems is such that the pointer itself will move to a new position. So this wave packet is being displaced to some new position. And the similar thing happens if the initial state, if we evolve this state under Schrodinger evolution.
If E is the wave function of the measurement device.
Yes, the wave function of the pointer on the measurement device. So if we have this wave function, and the pointer in its initial state, then under this evolution, we will get this. Okay, so I'm realizing that there isn't time to finish showing you how measurement works in the De Broglie-Bohm model, at least not if I want to do it carefully. So I'll stop just there and I'll carry on tomorrow morning to show you how measurement works. The interesting point is that after the measurement, the particles will end up in one of these two wave packets. And if the pointer is sufficiently large, if it has sufficiently many particles in it, then you can effectively ignore the other wave packet. So although the wave function doesn't collapse, it just continues to evolve according to the Schrodinger equation. Nevertheless, so far as the subsequent evolution of that particular system is concerned, it only continues to feel one of these two wave packets. So you have something like effective collapse. And I'll show you how that works tomorrow.